The term nostalgia derives from the Greek words nostos, return, and algos, pain. The literal meaning of nostalgia, then, is the suffering evoked by the desire to return to one's place of origin. For me, my place of origin? A cold October Sunday in Waldorf, Maryland. My dad is not turning the thermostat too high to save money, thus freezing out the rest of the family. I'm holding my copy of Bill Watterson's Yukon Ho, and I'm laughing out loud by myself. The cool thing about Watterson's work is that I don't long for a friend who isn't there. I can pick up that book in my office now, and just like that, I'm back there. No pain, no love lost. Just like Hobbes, when no one is around, those pages come to life. Watterson lives, and his work waits for me every time. My reservoir of joy will never run out, thanks to him. It's a magical world, Hobbs, old buddy. Let's go exploring. Shortbox Nation, we proudly present the artist spotlight of Mr. Bill Watterson.
Shortbox Nation, welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing today? To all of our new friends joining us for the first time, my name is Botter, here at your service to welcome you to the Shortbox Podcast, the comic review and talk show where you hear the best conversations about comic books and the pop culture they inspire. This is episode 379, and if that excellent intro didn't clue you in enough, today is all about us taking a nostalgic step back into the Scholastic Book Fair era of our lives and revisiting the adventures of comics' terrific tandem of Calvin and Hobbes, as well as paying our respects to the genius behind their creation. He's been called the Bigfoot of comics, but we like to call him Mr. Bill Watterson.
Who says that?
There's actually a quote. I'll have to find it, but another comic cartoonist had called him the Bigfoot.
That was a good Stan Lee intro you did. That was nice. I like the alliteration.
Now you'll learn why he's been called the Bigfoot of comics later on. But let's welcome the panel that's coming along for this trip down memory lane. Here in the studio with me is the exceptional Edmund Danzar.
Ooh.
What's up, Ed? How you
What's
doing?
Up?
You know, I'm always trying to build you up, Ed, finding all these $10 words.
What, exceptional is a $10 word? All right.
It's got more than five letters.
You're overpaying for
right.
whatever
Ed,
you use.
Come on. All right, man. I'm looking out for you. All right. All right. And calling in from Daddy Daycare is the man responsible for the intro you heard at the top of the show. Short Black Nation, I'm going to give him a round of applause because it's been a minute. We got Cesar Cordero here with us. What up, C?
For those that know, I was in a ska band called Hamster Huey and the Gooey Kablooey.
Ah.
And if that doesn't prove my Calvin and Hobbes cred, you guys can get fucked.
That's good.
I'm going to try to top that, all right? And she may not be here in person, but God damn it, is she here in spirit with us, all right? This next shout out is for, you know, our sister in podcast arms, our good friend, co-host extraordinaire, Ashley Lanny Hoy. I want to go ahead and give her and her family a round of applause for the arrival of their precious boy, Shiloh Reese Hoy. Super excited
Covering
about that.
Covering from the noodle incident.
That was a good time.
Another deep cut?
Yeah. That was a good time.
So Ashley was having her baby at the same hospital that Sarah works at, and Sarah was able to kind of peek in. And funny story is that after Sarah had her C-section, like, she wasn't able to move, and they kind of advise you kind of like, hey, just don't really get up. Like, you don't have to. In fact, you shouldn't. So Sarah goes to knock on the door to visit Ashley and Josh, and Ashley answers the door. She's like walking around. She's like, hey, what's up? And Sarah's like, what are you doing? You should be lying down. She's like, I feel fine. Oh, like, old. Oh my God. So Ashley already being an irresponsible mom from the jump. Mm-hmm. Oh, congratulations.
Man. We wouldn't expect anything.
She don't
better,
think
man.
The rules apply to her. That's a problem.
Nah.
We're excited for you, Ashley, and we're dedicating this one to you and your baby boy, all right? And while we're on acknowledgments, let's go ahead and talk about our incredible sponsors, Collective Con and Gotham City Limit. One is North Florida's premier pop culture event, and the other one is North Florida's premier comic shop. Both are the best at what they do, and they play a large part in helping us keep the lights on, alongside the contributions of our incredible Patreon community. And speaking of Patreon, ham-fistedly speaking of Patreon, we owe them a round of applause because this episode.
I thought you were going to say we owe them money.
That money's spent, Jack.
The show has gotten so bad that we owe the patrons money.
Refunds, Jack.
Wait, only at the short box would we owe our patrons fucking money.
That money spent, that is son.
Every month. Yo, I promise we'll get better.
We never promise anything.
We are in the negative, all right?
Just to clarify, we never promised that.
Thank you. That's coming from our legal department.
From the legal department? Yeah.
All right. Earlier in December, I believe that was the time, I presented our patrons with three classic comic strips to pick from. I wanted to do an episode highlighting the geniuses behind some of them, behind some of our favorite comic strips. So our patrons had the choice between Charles Schulz and Peanuts, Zitz, and Calvin and Hobbes.
But Zitz?
Zitz.
But Zitz is a personal favorite of mine, right? Oh, it was okay. My choice to pick the artist spotlight poll, and that's what I went with. I know you're rolling your eyes, Zitz. But I went with Zitz.
How many people voted for Zitz?
All right, actually,
zero?
One, and it's
negative?
Fuck
negative?
Here.
Can you get a negative on a poll?
I know Cesar wants to let a louder laugh, but like I said, he's got a sleeping baby, and I respect
my daughter is sleeping right now. I'm trying so hard.
Y'all are not going to sit here and disrespect. Let me see. What was
negative 8%? Negative 8%.
I'll show you.
All right. Here's the poll results for you assholes, right? Calvin and Hobbes won the poll with 67% of the votes. Peanuts with 22% and Zitz with 11% of the votes, all right? Third place, sure, but it wasn't one-digit a vote. There was at least one or two other people.
No Far Side? Oh, man.
Look, this man thinks Zitz is better than Far Side.
I know. Bloom County. Boondocks? No, even no Boondocks.
I almost picked Boondocks, but...
But the beautiful writing and artwork in Zitz just completely... completely overshadows anything Aaron
right.
Magruder
so
has
it wasn't
done for
the best
movement,
poll.
So.
It wasn't the best poll, but no surprise there. All right, Calvin Hobbes came out on top, and this is why we get to this is why we're together today.
Yo, your mom has Zitz. How about that shit?
Fuck out of here. My mom's Zitz. Got beautiful skin. All right, that's that Moroccan
she
oil.
She does huh?
Natural. Now, if you're a listener that wants to take part in these terrible polls that I pick. Or seriously, take part in picking the topics that we do discuss. I highly encourage you to join our Patreon community. We'll be looking to our patrons a lot this year to pick the topics for some upcoming episodes we got planned, including one for Ant-Man. We want to do an episode about Kang the Conqueror, so I'm going to have some choices for comics for our patrons to pick. And I know the thought of paying for another subscription is daunting, all right?
No, it's not. No, it's not.
It's not money bags over there, no. Mondo posters.
Not at all. No.
Well, for some
of
us,
this is a flex, by the way.
Oh, major flex! If you're watching the video version of this podcast, see, took note of all you haters out there complaining about his backdrop, and he brought the Mondo posters out. But for some of us, at least, that aren't money bags like Cordero over there, another subscription is a pain in the ass. But I'm gonna tell you straight up. We are not only cheaper than Netflix, but we are way more entertaining, all right? You're actually going to get your money's worth investing in us. And we're only asking
you
for a couple
of dollars. You couldn't even get it out.
I started thinking how much we owe our patrons. And
the patrons.
Scary.
This guy owes, not me.
But honestly, we are worth investing a couple of dollars into, especially if you want to support what we do in a bigger way in exchange for bonus episodes, perks, and other rewards that we got going on. Check out our Patreon membership plans by going to shortboxjacks.com or scroll through this episode show notes and click the support this show button. All right. Shameless plug is out the way. The table is now set to talk about our main topic today, Bill Watterson and Calvin and Hobbes. Gents, I remember checking out every single Calvin and Hobbes book that my middle school library had to offer back in the day. And occasionally, if I'm being honest, sometimes I wouldn't return them, right? Sometimes I'd just keep them because I knew it was worth my mom paying the late fee, all right? That's how much I love Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh, you mean stealing?
Stealing,
I get it.
You know, yeah. Purposely lost. I mean, it's a gray area. What do you think, legal department, yes. Ed? Was I stealing?
There's the, what is it? Enough time has elapsed.
There we go.
It's okay.
Thank you so much.
Statute of limitations.
Yep, there we go. Over.
See, take me back to the first time that you were exposed to Calvin Hobbes, man. Do you remember your first conscious exposure? Yo, this is Botter. Sorry for interrupting this episode, but I'll keep it brief. I wanted to let you know about a massive sale we have going on over at the Short Box Store on all of our merchandise and apparel. That's theshortboxstore.bigcartel.com. You can now save 20% off your entire order using the discount code YO, Y-O-O. So if you've been waiting for the right time to finally buy that gauntlet snapback, or if you ever wanted to buy any of the shirts you see me wear on the podcast, well, now's your chance to get them for a steal. We still have a few sizes left of everything, but they won't last long, and once they're gone, they are gone. And did I mention that all of our apparel is screen printed on high quality material? None of that heat transfer or direct to garment stuff. Our shirts are some of the most comfortable ones you'll ever wear, and the hats look even better in person. So wear your support for the Short Box Nation proudly, knowing that you're going to look damn good doing it. Get to theshortboxstore.bigcartel.com as soon as you can, and don't forget to use that discount code YO, Y-O-O, to save 20% off your entire order. All of this information can be found in this episode's show notes if you want to get there faster. Thanks for not pressing fast forward. Now back to the show.
I do, actually. I had to write this down because it's kind of weird, but it's one of those earliest memories I can actually remember. The ones I have, I was 5 years old. And I lived in California at the time with my dad. My dad was stationed in San Diego. He's in the Navy. And I was walking around with my mom and dad at a mall in the 80s. And there was the first collection, just simply called Calvin and Hobbes, at a B. Dalton bookstore. Here's what I remember is because I couldn't read at the time. But I very, very, very vividly remember seeing Calvin and Hobbes on the cover. And I was like, the artwork is so fantastic. Like it's cartoony, but like the watercolors just pop. It's something it was burned into my brain so much so that the next time I would see a Calvin and Hobbes book would be 5 years later when we moved to Maryland. And that was at the book fair at my elementary school there.
What about you, Ed? You got a favorite memory of the comic strip?
I think my first encounter, I want to say, my brief time in the Boy Scouts.
Wait.
Shout out to all the Weeblos out there.
We've been recording for almost, 8, 9 years? And yeah. I think it's the first time I ever heard that you were in the Boy Scouts.
Very, and it was not a memorable time.
Was it like for 48
Earned
hours or
zero badges. didn't even try.
You just got a participation badge? No, thanks for joining, I guess.
I don't know. It was very short time, but we went camping and there was this other kid who, you know, usually when you're young, the kids who draw or have some kind of, you know, artistic, like, you know, they like doing things artistic. They kind of gravitate towards each other. So this one kid was like, hey, man, you ever see Calvin and Hobbes? And newspaper strips were still around, but they were on their last legs. They were kind of on their way out, or, you know, what represents them were on their way out, or what I would like in a comic strip. So he showed me one of the books. And then, like you said, so you see that beautiful ink and watercolor cover of like them on the sled, you know, just kind of bursting out of the woods. You know, I forgot which one it was, but you know, he would show me because those books, they had those kind of nice watercolor intros, like those kind of the ones that weren't in the paper. So I remember, I think that's my first exposure to it. And then my folks were getting just the Sunday paper at the time. So I would always, you know, ask for the mom would get the coupons, and then I would get the Sunday paper, and they were the top. I think I was reading it towards the end of the run, so where he got like the half page, you know, or a quarter page,
yeah.
And he was doing some really cool stuff with panels, so I got to see kind of right before he tapped out. So I got to see kind of like his, you know, what he was fighting for the whole time he was doing this stuff. So I got to catch kind of the tail end of his career as a little kid, but I think that's my introduction to the characters.
Cool. All right. And this next part goes to our...
Well, what about you, dude?
Oh, well, I mean...
He stole it. Remember, he stole it from the library.
And it's not completely untrue, but I want to say...
I mean...
It was either middle school or high school. Right before I got into, like, as I was getting into, you know, superhero comics and the Marvel books my dad had... I would, you know, I'd go to the library or any of those Scholastic book fairs, and I was looking for anything comic related. So it just happened to, you know, I mean, you know how it is at Scholastic. The closest thing to comics you were going to get were either like the like the Marvel
Garfield
universe.
Books.
Garfield yeah, books. Comic strips. And then if it was Marvel related, it might be like a handbook or something like that, or a character guide.
Sure.
You know what I'm talking about? So I would just scoop up those and then anything comic strip related. And I just remember having this period of trying to read and consume as much Calvin Hobbes as I could. And I know like other kids were into it. We would trade books and trades, and I'd steal those too, and you know, be on the run from, you know, bullies and stuff. So,
jeez,
I had a problem as a kid. I still do. But yeah, Calvin Hobbes was like really big for me as I was getting into comics and like diving into that world.
Then you saw Zits, and that just totally took over your.
Yeah, he's never gonna live that down.
Man, Zits is my jam. Right, fuck it, man. I am proud to say Zits is my jam, and you guys will soon learn
and
that
you're
Bill
the
Watterson,
only one. Yes.
And Bill Watterson also was a fan, so fuck you guys.
I don't think I read that anywhere.
A memory that I cherish from my younger days, my grandpa on my dad's side, who he lived in Jersey for his whole life, but during the last couple years, maybe 3-4 years of his life, he moved down to stay with us. This is after his wife, my dad's mom, passed away. So he was really like the only one of two only grandparents I really got to know. I only got to know my grandma on my dad's side for my dad's mom for only like a couple years, and then she passed away. So I really got to spend time with my grandpa. He lived with us. And because of him, my dad bought a Florida Times Union subscription, because my grandpa just loved to read the paper. And he'd get it daily and Sunday, and that was something that we bonded over. I'd come in the garage. He'd be sneaking a pack of cigarettes, knowing damn well he wasn't allowed to smoke, but, you know, that is. And he would give me the Sunday paper to keep quiet, like, you know, don't let your dad see this. So, yeah, I used to just consume comic strips, man. And Calvin Hobbes, I mean, wasn't syndicated then, obviously. I mean, it ended in 95. So I was catching up on trades and anything the library or Scholastic book fairs had, but it had a big impact. And that's a big reason why I wanted to do an episode highlighting comic strips and, you know, the work that these creators put into, because it was something that me and C were talking about is you know, we've highlighted plenty of times on this show the trials and tribulations and the amount of work that goes into creating a monthly, you know, comic book, you know. But when you think about, you know, comic strips and that whole business model and the syndication behind those, you know, that is an extraordinary, you know, feat of labor that goes into creating these comic strips on a daily basis. You know, you think about the writing.
Yeah, that's your full-time job. Mm-hmm. Like you are, like Bill Watterson talks about having to scour and excavate any minute of his life for a possible idea for a story. And how it was just so taxing. But the payoff for him was that he was able to say he was a legitimate artist. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, I'm taking this serious, and I'm not just a joke machine for, you know, insert publication.
And it wasn't like a lot of strips, especially, I guess now it's almost like cut and paste, and it just serves the punchline. Mm-hmm. You know, the images are secondary.
This is off to a good start. And before we go in any deeper, I want to take a quick step back, and I want to offer a hyper-condensed crash course into the very rich career of Bill Watterson. We won't get into the nitty-gritty. There's Wikipedia for that, and there's a really good documentary from 2013 that's on YouTube. It's called Dear Mr. Watterson, and that's a good starting point as well. What I'm going to share is really just to level the playing field for anyone listening that isn't really familiar with Bill Watterson's overarching life and in the high points. All right, here we go. Bill Watterson was born in Washington, D.C. in 1958. He moved to Chagrin Falls, Ohio at 6 years old. Watterson was described by his parents as kind of a recluse child. He was kind of a loner, but he could draw, and he found an escape in the arts. So no surprise there, but he was also a fan of comic strips of the time, like the Peanuts. I think Pogo was one, and the Crazy Cat.
Walt Kelly's Pogo, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Throughout high school and well into college, where Watterson would major in political science, he was feeding that creative fire by drawing comics and superheroes with his friends and contributing cartoons and strips to his school newspapers. He was pretty confident and dead set early on being a professional cartoonist one day. After college and very early on in his career, Bill Watterson would befriend one of his biggest inspirations, Jim Borgman, who was a political cartoonist for the Cincinnati Inquirer, but also the creator of one of my favorite comic strips, proudly, the Zits. Bill Watterson, big fan wanted to be just like Jim Borgman, so much so that he kind of mimicked Jim Borgman's career pretty faithfully early on. Watterson would land his first professional gig as a cartoonist for the Cincinnati Post, which was a competing paper to Jim Borgman's Cincinnati Inquirer. But Bill Watterson would not enjoy the same longevity as Borgman because he was fired pretty early on in his contract. Watterson would bounce back, and he found work at an advertising agency as a designer, a career path that we've seen echoed among other comic greats. Neil Adam comes to mind, kind of pursuing
just
the same.
Just to jump in, he was doing ads for like a grocery chain, like a grocery store. So he's designing coupons and stuff.
Yeah, and I understand that he wasn't a really big fan of that work. And that actually kind of motivated him to start working on coming up with comic strip ideas and getting those out and trying to see what would work. Of course, it was here that he developed the comic strip that we're talking about today. Calvin and Hobbes was picked up for syndication by Universal Press Syndication, and it debuted in 35 newspapers on November 18th. Calvin and Hobbes, in its heyday, ran in over 250 newspapers. It was translated across the world for a global audience for a very consistent and very successful 10 years, from 1985 to 1995. But despite immense acclaim and winning a shit ton of awards, for lack of better terms, this guy has so many Eisner and Harvey Awards to his names and collected editions. It wasn't enough to stop him from retiring the strip on November 9th, 1995. He wrote a letter to the editors and fans initially stating that, quote, "I believe I've done what I can do within the constraints of daily deadlines and small panels." In later interviews, he cited that heated contract renegotiations and pressure from Universal to license and merchandise Calvin Hobbes played a big role in his decision. He said he was leaving millions of dollars on the table, but it wasn't never enough to make him waver from his anti-merchandising stance, believing that doing so would cheapen his characters. Watterson has since lived a peaceful and private life in Ohio with his wife, pursuing other artistic ventures that come along the way, and staying pretty far away from the press and spotlight. I think he's only really graced...
What's in the water in Ohio, dude?
Right?
I mean, Dave Chappelle lives in Ohio. He did the exact same thing. Left millions of dollars on the table for artistic integrity, man.
Well said. Yep. Watterson, for the most part, has stayed away from the press, from the spotlight. Like we said, he's really only kind of graced his loyal fans with the occasional poster, maybe a print here, a comic strip cameo here and there. I believe one of the most notable things he did was he took over for Pearls and Swine one day out of the year and actually drew that whole entire strip. You can find that online pretty easily. But for the most part, it's been kind of dry for Bill Watterson and Calvin and Hobbes fans since then. Ed, you're someone that loves comic history and studying the careers of comic greats like I am. Were you familiar with Bill Watterson's career? Did you learn anything new or interesting in your research?
It's been a while since I've looked at a Calvin and Hobbes comic strip, honestly. And it's one of those things where you revisit it and it's like, it's just as good as you remember it, if not better, because you appreciate it more. But he's always been a mysterious figure, even back then. And like I said, this is, I was familiar, but I did learn some new things. I learned that, like I said, you went over some of them. I know that there was a chance for him to get signed by United, but they wanted him to use a character called Robot Man. So it basically goes like, hey, this is a cute comic, kid. Let's instead of that tiger, Robot Man. There's this guy over in England, Peter Shelley. He's like a music label executive, pop singer, songwriter type of guy. I'm telling you, kid, we're doing the full Garfield treatment here. We're doing buttons, we're doing underwear, we're doing calendars, we're doing toys. And this was early. This was before he got signed to Universal. So that could have been an instant in right there. Money's on the table. And he turned it down. That's always been the constant thing, is how much his perspective and his integrity, you know, over these years. It's like he could have made, I mean, I've read like it could, they could have made at least $500 million they left on the table.
I'm rich, bitch.
And the fact that he didn't do it, and the fact that he could have done it, and I don't think he would have lost any respect as an artist.
Look, Jim Davis is still around and nobody shits on him.
So he's the exact opposite. Those are the two – because Jim Davis basically – he pretty much stopped drawing Garfield in the 80s. Like you look at early Garfield and you look at mid-80s Garfield, that's not the same guy drawing it. But he has that stamp with his name on the corner. That's for damn sure. And he's got about a dozen people running his empire. And I remember reading a thing. It's like I got into this for the art – to draw comics, not to run like a factory of bullshit, you know? So that's a crazy thing I didn't know that was, I mean, he had that easy in, and some people would take that as an in, and then, okay, now I can do my thing. I do this. It's like you do the safe picture, then you do the indie artist picture. You know, you do the blockbuster, then you do the artsy stuff, yeah. You know, just to
two
kind
for
of,
them, one for me.
Yeah. Two for them, one for me. But he was steadfast, and it wasn't, I don't know if it was 100% against, I mean, there's a big part of it, but I think the main thing is he wanted that, the control of what to do. You know, like I said, I know he was approached to do like animation. That's something I learned too, but it was one of those deal where it's like a developmental deal, but it's like, here's a grand, we get first right refusal. So that's not going to pay the bills for too long. Another thing I learned too is like he did get his rights when he re-signed in 91. So he was able to get the rights to his characters back. So that's why we still haven't seen any dolls or official merchandise for Calvin and Hobbes. And he kind of went to New Mexico to even be more secluded. I'm sure part of that is like the, like his love for, George Harriman's Crazy Cat and his kind of desert. If you look at those Crazy Cat cartoons, you see those ink lines and stuff. You can see, okay, that's, I see where a lot of this is coming from. So he's got
references to it in his own work.
So I can picture him like, if you've seen Kill Bill, like his Bill's brother's in the desert in a trailer. He's just with a drawing board in the middle of nowhere in the desert, just drawing.
Is that where he ended up retiring? Is in as New Mexico?
I think he went back to Ohio.
Okay, got it.
I don't think he can stay to New Mexico. Got it. How long can you live there, honestly? For real.
For real. Stupid. I think we should also say if you are someone that has seen or owns the infamous sticker that you'll see in the back of a lot of trucks of Calvin pissing on whatever it may be, right? You can Photoshop whatever underneath the piss. That
so
is
lame.
A bootleg, ladies and gentlemen. All right, that is not official Calvin and Hobbes merch.
Yeah, and he kind of laughs about it now, but he said it was too much to try to, you know, he can't
hunt it all
sue
down
everybody. Yeah, he can't hunt everyone down, so he just kind of let it go. And then along with those Pearl Before Swine, where he did the guest panels, there was also Berkeley Breathitt, who was a friend of his.
Yeah.
There was like, and I haven't read his stuff in a while, but in 2016 to 2021, Hobbes as the doll would just pop up in random in strips. Not Berkeley's art, but like how Watterson would draw them. So it could be either he... What I think happened, and I could see him doing this, is he sent him a blank Bristol board. He had it all paneled out, and he would draw Hobbes in whatever panel, and then he would just write around it. So that's kind of cool. He had that little Easter egg in his comic strips for that long.
Good stuff. Thank you, Ed. I'm going to add one little tidbit to everything you shared, which I think you and C might really fuck with this. Bill had a brother named Tom Watterson, who in the early 90s had a pop rock band called The Rels. And Bill actually did the artwork for all of the band's releases using a pseudonym, Fang Vampire. And if you could find a couple of those cover art.
Who knew Bill Watterson was a goth dude?
If you read Calvin and Hobbes, yeah.
Yeah, it's some depressing stuff.
You can find some of those album covers and projects that he did on Google pretty easily. But it looks nothing like his art in Calvin Hobbes. If anything, it looks like either the prototype or his best take on Bill Sienkiewicz's style, which I think they were doing, around this time. Bill Sienkiewicz was doing New Mutants. It is super trippy.
Yeah, I could see Sienkiewicz and like Ralph Steadman kind of stuff in there too.
See, there's only a few episodes where you would threaten my livelihood if I record without you, and this one I think was one of those for sure. It was cool to talk to you leading up to this week, getting excited for the episode, and I'll be honest, I didn't know that you had that many copies of Calvin and Hobbes and basically had what it sounds like the entire kind of collected, you know, trades and whatnot. What strips or like material did you specifically read for this episode, and what was like a standout?
For the record, I did not threaten your livelihood. I would never do that. I would never take another man's money. I threatened your manhood. Okay?
Oh, okay.
I said that's I would. Right, right. Said I would chop off your
cut off your Johnson
if you did not. Yes, cut off your Johnson, Lebowski. It's hard for me because I'm constantly reading and rereading his stuff. And as far as my, I'll go on the record as far as this episode is concerned. Calvin Hobbes is my favorite comic, just because it. It inspired and influenced me so much. So when you ask me a question like, hey, what strips, it's like, oh man, how do I pick? 10th anniversary is a good place to start if you're a fan and you want to know what the inside of Bill Watterson's head looks like. And as a result, there's a strip in there where Calvin and Hobbes find a baby raccoon that's been injured. And Calvin goes to get his mom to see if she can do anything, nurse it back to health, and do something. And it's one of the most heaviest strips. And the other strip I think that resonated with me was when Calvin broke his father's very expensive pair of binoculars. And he is eating himself alive with guilt for, like, I guess, because it's a weekly strip, and every day he's putting something out. So for probably about a good 4 days worth of comic book adventures, you get Calvin just, if you've ever been in a situation where you had borrowed something from a parent or guardian and you broke it and you felt horrible, right? And you didn't know how they were going to act about it. And oh, the pain, he captures it so well. And it's funny because now that I'm a dad, I'm looking at my daughter and she gives me these, like, she's 9 months old. So she's looking up at me and giving me these kind of like, hey, mischievous grins and stuff.
I'm breaking and this shit.
And the way she looks is just kind of like, oh man, I'm going to enjoy these comics on another level because Calvin's parents are good. They're good people. 10th anniversary is a good book. It's just all around. And both those strips are in there. You just kind of have to dig through.
Yeah, I kind of want to just follow up on that raccoon one because I was going to mention that as well. That one is so, like, heavy, like you said, but there's, like, the follow-up strip was, like, after the main strip where he's, like, it's like, man, it's so unfair that, you know, I just met this guy and he died, but in a weird way, I'm happy this happened. So he's learning empathy.
Yeah, he's not nihilistic.
Yeah, like, he's not Calvin a sociopath. Calvin is a kid. I never thought of him as a bad kid, per se.
He's six years old.
And I relate to this a lot. He's just a lonely kid. You look at his world, his parents are, and they're doing, and I don't think the parents are negative figures.
They both have jobs.
Like, the teacher's always browbeating him. He's bullied at school. Susie can only stand him for a few minutes. You know, and his buddy is Hobbes. You know, this is a lonely fucking kid, but he's also a six-year-old. So he has this enlightened thought of, I'm glad this happened, even though it's so sad. And then the six-year-old in the final panel is like, what a stupid world.
Yeah. He says,
or what a dumb world or something.
No, it's stupid. Yeah, okay. He says, I wish he wasn't dead, even though he is. And I'm sad and it hurts that he's gone. I'm happy to have met him. And I didn't even know he existed until a couple days ago. And like Ed said, then like the last panel is him walking away with Hobbes saying, what a stupid world.
And there's the six-year-old.
There's a whole page, a whole extra days or four more panels where Hobbes and Calvin are in bed and they're talking about the nature of death. And they're like, man, like, that's crazy. Like, how this all happened. And like, what does it all mean? And then like the last panel is them under their bed because they scared themselves into sort of a weird existential dread. And they're like, why are we talking about this at night?
At the sake of sounding a little meta right now, hearing us, how recognizable these stories are and us kind of throwing off, you know, like these, hey, that strip about the raccoon, hey, the strip about that. It almost sounds like we're talking about our favorite, like, song or something like that, mm-hmm. right? Like our favorite movie. And I think that's a commonality when I talk to other people about Calvin Hobbes is everyone knows the classics, and then everyone's got their favorite, you know, B-side or strip that maybe, you know, most others don't like. And I think that's just a testament to, one, I think the longevity of Bill Watterson's career, even though, like, compared to maybe some other folks, you're like, eh, there's, you know, 10 years is short and maybe the bigger picture of things. But when you drill down to how many comics, you know, 10 years, 365 days in a year, like, he was writing a strip almost every day.
Yeah, and
like,
he had no assistants. A lot of those guys
wild,
have a team,
right?
You know,
yeah.
Working
one man shop.
Yeah. Just like Charlie Brown.
Charles Schultz.
Wow. That's weird. But yeah, he's basically. Charles Schultz, even though he kind of had this big kind of commercial empire, he was drawing those strips till the end. You could see with the line and kind of how it was a shakier line towards the end of the Peanuts run. I mean, he was going till the very end. And he, even at that point in his life, he worked by himself.
Yeah. I wanted to chime in and say that for this one, I went ahead and dusted off Attack of the Deranged Mutant Killer Monster Snow Goons trade paperback or collected edition.
Because
the name is so wild and funny. Snow Goon is a great fucking phrase. That's what I call all my snowmen. Right? I don't make snowmen. I make snow goons.
The one where it's like looked like a car hit him, and or like a group of snow. Oh my god, it's so funny!
It's not the title story that was my favorite in this collection, but it was a one in particular where Calvin and his neighbor Susie are playing doctor and patient.
Oh, that's a great
one.
The
art style is flipped. Actually, let me see.
It's like Mary Worth or something, like a adventure comic or
serial romance comic from the '60s.
Yeah, so
it's like a baby. I don't want a baby.
So if you don't read it to the very end, you're like, where the hell is this coming
this
from?
Is
like,
awesome.
The art style has changed. Like, who are these adults? Who's this doctor? When you read the dialogue, it is so funny. Two adults in a doctor's office setting, you know, doing a routine visit. But the dialogue and words coming out of their mouth is like, oh, this is obviously just two children fucking
even
fun at
each other. First, like, throwaway jokes. Like, I brought something home today. He's like, I hope it's a divorce or something like that.
That's when they're playing house.
Yeah. He's like, Mr. Bunt can be our baby. He's like, this.
So Botter, to, I think what you're tapping on here is that typically in Calvin and Hobbes, you have a child and his stuffed tiger speaking like adults. Here, the comedy comes from adults treating each other like immature children. And it's chef's kiss good.
It's a prime example of how Bill Watterson's comedy works on so many levels. Like, there's the joke at the surface, there's a middle layer, and then there's a deeper one if you want to go that deep. And I think this is a prime example of that. But also, the range of Bill Watterson's style and abilities as an artist, like that, you know, he can go ahead and completely give you a different style in the same collection. And he does this quite a few times, whether it be like going monochromatic, doing the Spaceman spliff, the Spaceman stuff, and some of the other adventures that he puts Calvin in. Like, he shows you, like, I can kind of do it all, right? He doesn't strike me as someone that brags, you know, verbally. He doesn't sound very verbose, but he really lets the his work kind of speak for
it. And it's cool because it's the fantasy part of the strip is the more realistically rendered.
Yes.
So it switches that element of what's fantasy, because he's always said this comic's more than an imaginary friend, you know, a tiger that comes to life when, you know, no one else is around. So in going on that, I really loved his dinosaur stuff.
Oh yeah.
And I remember in that 10th anniversary book, there was like one, he said that when Jurassic Park came out, he didn't draw dinosaurs for like a year. he's like, how can I compete with the millions of dollars on screen? But there was one I thought, and you can tell he can kind of think, like, kind of go back to being a kid. There's a couple it relates. One, it was the Tyrannosaurus Rexes in the F-14s or F-16s.
Classic. They're flying.
And then there's the one where he's flying and then blows up his skull with a jet. And he got so much heat for that. And he's like, it's like, I hated school. Like, what kid didn't dream about, you know, blowing up their school, you know?
Right.
And this was before all the, you know, school shootings and stuff happened. This was way before that. But it's just a kid fantasy.
At this age of finding Calvin and Hobbes, I think Bart Simpson was also another character that I looked at as a kid, like, oh, I wanted to be Bart Simpson, but I was not going to get an ass whooping for all the shit he's done, right? Like, I was not going to risk that. Calvin, to me, was, I think, who I maybe related to closer at that age, where vivid imagination, didn't have a bunch of friends. I think, you know, my brothers were my friends, right? But school friends-wise, I didn't have a lot, but I was always drawing. So, like, Calvin really resonated with me as a kid. And you would think that, you know, Bill Watterson writes Calvin so well, gives him such a unique and believable childlike, you know, this is an adult writing a child, like a really believable child. You would think like, oh, he's just pulling from his own life. You know, this must have been how he was as a kid. And this is where that well of inspiration is coming from. But then, like I said in the beginning, you know, his parents are telling you, no, he was actually a recluse. He wasn't, you know, very social at all.
Quiet kid.
So even for Bill Watterson, it must have been, I wonder if it was therapeutic to write, you know, like what he wanted to be as a kid, you know, what he wished he would have been able to do.
If you have the 10th anniversary, he talks about it. He says that he says he loves the character of Calvin because he's so not like him.
Yeah.
He says, I love writing for Calvin because I'm nothing like him. And it's easy for me to put myself in a state of, okay, what wouldn't I have done as a child? And just really go in places where my mind is like, this is fun.
That's
because
cool.
It's not me. He says he very often disagrees with Calvin.
Yeah. And that's kind of what Hobbes, that's kind of where he kind of argues against the imaginary friend thing, because they are always at odds. You know, they have a lot in common, but there's a lot of philosophical differences between the two, named after the philosophers.
Yeah. Tom Hobbes and John Calvin.
But even like when you said, it's like when he would do the strips with the kid drawings and the kid style lettering, it's like that guy is a fantastic letterer.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh,
you know, he would do like when Calvin's drawing something to show his dad or whatever, and it goes back to like, it looks like a legit children's drawing. It's like he's so technically precise in his work.
I think I would be able to pick out that typeface for Calvin and Hobbes and the font he uses from anywhere. You could just have it lined up in a bunch of other types, and I could probably pull that out. I wanted to make one more mention as far as one of my favorite comic strips. And this was one that, honestly, I was introduced to just this morning by Cesar. We hopped on a call, you know, just sharing our excitement for the episode, getting warmed up.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
And I was asking him what his favorite was. I was telling him about the Doctor one. And C shared with me one I hadn't seen. It was one, I don't think it had an official name, but it starts off, you know, first there was nothing, then there was Calvin. And it's basically Calvin imagining himself as God creating a universe.
That's a good one.
See what I'm saying is like, yeah. I don't even have to, there is no
he's
names
like
or titles for
hand.
These.
Yeah, he's got the beard.
These
yeah,
are
that's
the
a
best
great
hits,
one.
Right? Like
yeah.
Calvin Hobbes has got, so anyways, that strip is so good. Like, and once again, art style completely throws you off in the beginning. You're like, oh shit, okay, this is one of those stories where the imagination, mm-hmm. you know, this is that perspective. In the last two panels, or I don't even think the last two, I think the last panel brings it home, and you realize, oh, it's Calvin playing with these new toys of his, and he's, you know, he's playing God or whatnot.
So there's an example of what you're talking about. Like, what syndicated newspaper comic strip artist was basically saying, okay, here are the influences I'm going to pull in for this particular episode. I'm going to use Michelangelo's, you know, version of God visually. Mm-hmm. I'm going to comedically kind of spoof the idea of maybe some of these religions that portray God in a bloodthirsty way might be saying something about the childish nature of that kind of a God, while also then kind of bringing it home and saying, by the way, the stakes are freaking low, guys. I wasn't really saying any of that because turns out it's just a shitty little kid playing with Tinker toys.
Yeah.
And his parents are none the wiser, right? Like, so it's like, there's so much going on and there's so much setup, punchline.
Is that the one where, like, they're like, he's been quiet for a while. We better go check on him.
It's literally only one panel, yeah. And the parents are proud. Like, it's like, you know, Calvin's really been, you know, really taken with these Tinker toys. Like, he hasn't said much. Like, it's kind of like, yes, because he's freaking, he's acting like a crazy god, this evil deity.
It is imagination squared captured on paper. Like, once again, going back to like how multi-layered it is, these characters are products of Watterson's imaginations. So you've already got that. But then he's portraying the imaginations of said imagined characters that he came up with, right? Like, mm-hmm. it is so multi-layered. And like I said, you could take it at face value. It's a really well-drawn strip, very funny. You could go down deeper down the rabbit hole to where Cesar took it, and then there's that middle layer. It's just impressive all around. And to think that he was able to do this, 365, 7 days a week, mm-hmm. whatever it may be. Yeah, he had to dig in some very deep places.
Can I also make a recommendation?
Yeah, hit it.
The Washington Post, and I actually cut it out and I saved it when I was, 1995. I was in eighth grade about to go into high school. They put out an article called So Long, Kid, and it was written by a journalist. His name is Frank Ahrens. So if you can find So Long, Kid by the Frank Ahrens, Washington Post, It's a tearjerker. It's amazing, and it's a really good tribute to Calvin and Hobbes. I actually still have the cutout article in the 10th anniversary book. It's freaking yellow and old, and I need to laminate it or something.
That's good stuff. I'm going to stop myself from also jumping in on this best of Calvin hit list, and I want to move on. I want to move the conversation to talking about some of the themes that you find prevalent in his work. We've kind of touched on some of them. I want to go a little deeper into what are some of the themes that you find abundant in his work, and see if you don't mind taking that first.
Sure. I don't know if his work is thematic so much as it is an autobiography written in parable. Hmm. And if there is a theme to his work, I think it's never underestimate the reader's appetite for quality.
Hmm.
That's what I would say the theme is.
Oh, those little pause break.
Yeah, that's like, that pregnant pause just was drop, nice.
Drop this mic. Hold on. Let me get another one. Yeah.
That's a good mic seat. Damn, well said. He tends to sprinkle in like commentary too, yeah. Like on the comic medium, the occasional commentary about the industry that he's in, his, you know, working and personal encounters with fame and you know, what he had going on. But I don't think you would catch that. It's not very apparent unless you knew about like his struggles, you know, with the syndication thing and you know, pressure to merchandise. Like, I think this is where his private nature benefits the comics, where it doesn't feel, unless you know what's going on. If you know, you know. If you knew what was going on behind the scenes, then you can kind of catch certain Easter eggs. But I don't think he ever lets the behind the scenes drama take center stage. It's always about like, you know, embodying like innocence and childhood imagination.
Yeah, there's, like I said, I can't really put one wide net over it because he does tackle a lot of different things. Even if it's just for a strip, he'll make fun of art criticism. But I would say it's like there's some really subversive kind of misanthropic stuff about humanity, which is, you know, Hobbes' nature, or Hobbes the philosopher's, you know, basically his philosophy. And just boundless imagination, but there's that, and maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just projecting because of my childhood. But there's kind of like this loneliness and this kind of escapism with this imagination. That's, you know, it's a lot of reflective stuff, a lot of insightful things. But I see it, and I see this with Peanuts too, where it's just kind of this. You're making the best of a relentlessly cruel world. You're like said, Charlie Brown never gets the redhead girl, never wins the baseball game. Everyone calls him a blockhead, never kicks the football. That kid is just, but he still goes through, his only friend is Snoopy. I see a lot of like parallels there.
Yeah. Good people won't add to the misery that this world has doled out randomly. And if they can make it a little bit better, then that's what we need to concentrate on, right? Even Calvin, as imperfect and as petulant sometimes as he is, and as you said, misanthropic as he is, he still adds to the world with his creativity, his imagination, and his empathy.
Mm-hmm. And it's just like that last strip where it's like, well, we have this blank canvas. We can
let's go exploring the world. It's a nice reset point. We have chances in life that we can reset things. We can start over. We can kind of take a new path. And it's basically that snow represents that. It's like, let's go exploring. And he just drives. It was a beautiful end to that strip.
Well said.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So you both know Watterson, he hasn't been in the news much at all since his retirement. But there was a recent headline back in November of last year about an original hand-colored Calvin and Hobbes strip selling at auction for $480,000, making it one of the most valuable comic strips ever sold. You're both artists in your own right. What do you think makes his art style unique and a standout from his contemporaries?
What set him apart, especially for comics at the time, was just the skill level he would develop. And I'm not saying a lot of these artists can't draw, you know, maybe Scott Adams. He doesn't.
I will. Yeah.
But
you took the words out of my mouth.
But, you know, the visuals are secondary in a lot of comics during that day. But he wanted to put those visuals in the forefront. He's old school. He's using a Windsor brush. He's using pen nibs. He's using classic equipment. This was pre-digital coloring, you know, or at least the early stages of digital coloring. He's working in these very strict parameters. Every strip looks different, even if it's just Calvin standing around. You never see like a stock cut and paste foreheads with a punchline. You know, that's what set him apart. I mean, he's like a throwback. He was like a throwback to George Harriman, to Winsor McCay, to a lot of those classic newspaper artists when the medium was at least given more room to be expressed, you know, given more room in the paper. The technical skill that he was showing at comics that time, it popped off the page, especially when he was getting that half page layouts and playing with the panels where it wasn't just the 9-panel grid, you know, or however many panels it was. It was just like circles. It was no panels. It was just one big picture sometimes. Man, he was really doing some inventive stuff in a medium that doesn't exist anymore, essentially.
Well said. Thank you, Ed. So you want to chime in on that?
Sure. So Watterson is unique in that he desperately wants to shove in as much artistic beauty in as many styles as you can shake a stick at in 6 panels on Sunday and 4 every day of the week. That's a lot of art. And his contemporaries, as far as I'm concerned, they're not Scott Adams. They're not Gary Trudeau. And that's not throwing shade on those guys. They're Neil Adams. They're Al Williamson. They're Gary Gianni. I name dropped Gary Gianni and Al Williamson because they both worked on Prince Valiant, which is another one of those art strips that, like, say what you want about the story, but the artwork is fantastically beautiful.
It's Alex so Raymond, boring. It's guy boring, created, but beautiful.
God damn, it's boring.
Yeah.
But it looks good.
Bernie Wrightson, too. I'll throw him in there.
You can say like even like Wally Wood, Frank Rosetta, those guys started in strips too.
Sure.
You
know? Yeah. Since our listeners are maybe more familiar with comic books as opposed to the graphic art of, you know, comic strip, I would compare him to Stuart Immonen in that both he and Stuart Immonen are similar in that they can change styles at the drop of a hat to match the story.
The versatility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said. I'll add in that I think there is a believable and effortless movement between panels whenever he draws, especially any strip involving Hobbes pouncing on Calvin, which, you know, it's kind of a running gag.
It's definitely kinetic.
Stories. Yeah, yeah, right? The way he shows movement in those specific comics, like, your eye, like, it just flows really well, even between the gutters. Like, you know, there's nothing there, but the way he draws it, it's kind of like a seamless connection from the previous panel, you know, even though, and the way he plays with time too, right? Like, it's not every second, but you can still see, like, your mind still kind of fills in the blanks in between that kind of gutter spaces. I'll also say, like, his settings, man, whimsical, really detailed, and it feels like he transports you, like, on location, right? Like, grew up in Jacksonville, Florida all my life, right? But when I read Calvin and Hobbes, I feel like I'm being transported to, you know, a small town or on a home that's got like some woods in the back. And I've never seen woods, right?
Let me tell you right now, he nails it. I didn't grow up in Florida. So now that I've lived here long enough, I realize there's nothing but just swamp and palm trees. and the seasons don't change. And up north, I was able to enjoy Calvin and Hobbes because I did build snowmen. I did go out sledding. I had a cold in the wintertime, and it sucks. And, you know, all the stuff that they're talking about and like waiting for summer to come and be like, oh, I can't wait. Cause you're like, winter's awesome for the first 2 months. And then you're like, oh, we got how many more months of this? And then you get the flu or whatever. But anyway, like, yes, Botter, he nails it.
Yeah. And I'll go ahead and say it. I think he draws some of the best snow. John Romita Jr., I think, draws rain like really well. He draws rain like it is like pouring, you know, 40 days and 40 nights. Bill Watterson in snow is a match made in heaven. You feel like you could like grab snow from the comic itself and make a little snowball. And last but not least, I'll say Bill Watterson nails expressions. Like the range of faces that he can give Calvin are so impressive, and it feels like there's no limit to, you know, what facial expression Calvin may have. And that is one thing that I think made it really stand out to me when I was really into comic strips and reading, you know, the daily paper and the Sunday paper, was comic strips like Garfield and even Boondocks. Even though I loved Boondocks, I really enjoyed Garfield. It got a little stale because it was always the same facial expression. The character designs didn't really change a lot. Like, you just knew what you were getting into. But with Calvin and Hobbes, like we had mentioned, he plays around with the style so much. And, you know, the face is always like a really emotive. And I think that's what really sets it apart from some of his contemporaries.
For sure.
Like we've kind of mentioned, Bill Watterson is a very private person. You can count on two hands how many interviews he has granted the public in the span of his career. Like literally, you could count them all on like two hands very easily. And that list is even shorter if you're counting official artwork that he's put out in the to the public since the end of Calvin and Hobbes. Like, he's very selective with his projects, if he takes any projects at that. Like, the man is a recluse to the highest magnitude. I was curious to hear from both of you, do you think Watterson's private nature and the lack of like merchandising and that stuff, has that had a positive or negative impact on the legacy of Calvin and Hobbes and potential discoverability for like future generations?
If you ask me when I'm 10, I will tell you, why can't I buy Hobbes' stuffed animal? But I'm 10 and I'm an idiot. If you ask me now, I think he did the best possible thing as an artist. He brought so much credibility to anybody that's ever wanted to do a newspaper style strip. Anyone that's ever wanted to do it and thought, well, the only way I can and hold on to my artistic integrity, I don't care about the money, is to sell out. And he was like, no, you don't have to do that. If you care about the art form, then care about the art form. He lives. He's never going to die. Calvin and Hobbes is his Bible. It's autobiographical. Like, he's in 10 years, he's managed to basically let you peek inside of how he thinks about things politically, philosophically, what his views are on the afterlife, what he thinks of his mom and dad. Does he believe in the power of love, imagination, loyalty, friendship, bureaucratic systems? I mean, he's institutions, yeah. Favorite foods. He's got it all in there. Like, it's really, really cool. And I think that his work is an exercise in parable. And I can have a good time anytime I pick up any one of those books and not worry about whether or not the integrity of his work was ever compromised. I can't speak for the future. You know, after he passes away, I don't know what's going to happen. And someone might, something evil and some draconian, you know, machination might make it so where his stuff is available for the public to consume in a way that is not in line with his wishes. You know, we'll burn that bridge when we get to it. But for now, he's the GOAT.
Well said. And I think when you think about what you just shared, I think it amplifies what Watterson himself shared in that last letter to the editors, which was, you know, for lack of better terms, I've said everything I've had to say. Ed, what about you, man? What are your thoughts on lack of merchandising and impact on the legacy?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with C. It adds to his mythos. You know, it's like I don't want to see him on Twitter talking about with political views. I think he's like, for me, as private as I am, he's kind of like, if I could have made it as an artist, that's like, man, this is like the perfect career. Although I would love some action figures of my stuff, I'm not gonna lie. But it's like you said, he believed in the art form over, like, the, you know, I remember reading something where it's like, it's not, you know, if we can, you know, merchandise, is like, why should we? We need to ask why we're doing this. And I don't think, because like I said, we even like growing up in the 80s and 90s, we're used to like, okay, we get the comic, we get some toys, we get the movie, we get the, you know, but he wanted, and he could be a control freak. I don't know. I don't need to know the man personally. It's like, you don't want, I kind of like that mystery about him. I don't want to know his, you know, picadillos and his odd, you know, things that make up everybody. You know, sometimes you just want some distance. And I think, and I'm glad he came up without Twitter and social media and stuff. Although I'm kind of curious to what he thinks about the Wild West we have now as far as doing comic strips, where
he loves it. He's comment. It's actually in the first four pages of the 10th anniversary. He talks about how not comic strips, comic books.
Yeah.
He says they're flourishing. Mm-hmm. This is 1995. So that means he's aware of what's going on. And by that point, Image had already come out. Mm-hmm. You know, by that point, you know, Marvel and DC were already well established.
But even like webtoons or even like daily strips that are just online specifically.
Oh, I'm sure he's jazzed about that.
You know what he would say? He'd say, y'all ain't getting paid for it. Could not be me.
Yeah. That's that's the thing too. That's what you give up, because you have this publishing house, the syndication, where I think he made, you know, he didn't need to get rich, but I think he's all right because of the book sales. They're New York Times bestsellers. They've been in reprints, millions of editions. Like I said, those nice hardcovers that came out 5 or 6 years ago, there's going to be another hardcover set that comes out, I'm sure. He's getting those checks still. So I'm not worried about him financially, but it's nice that he basically did something artistic completely on his terms. And that's rare. You know, nobody meddled with him. Nobody. And even the merchandising things, I think if he signed off, and like, he wouldn't even have to like run a factory. And I don't think if he put out a limited edition statue or dolls or something, I don't think anyone would call him a sellout. You know, it's like, you know, this is once you get into like the kids' meals and, you know, once you get into like underwear and like all kinds of crazy shit, and then we can have that talk. But he just stood firm, and he could have cashed out, and he could still cash out. He could come up and say, yeah, I want to make a Hobbs doll official. Put them in Targets, $20.
Right.
You know, he could do that in a snap.
He holds himself to such a rigorous standard. You know, like, the normal is here and his standard is here. And it's like, Bill, we just want you to meet us in the middle.
And that's the thing with artists, always say we don't do it for the money, but we need money to pay shit. You know, JEA don't accept, you know.
Will you take this trade from
exposure,
my electricity bill?
You know?
So here's a cool thing about what you just said, Ed, is that Roger Corman has this really cool speech where he talks about film being a compromised art form, in the sense that if it's just one guy making a movie, which means he has the money to make it, to buy all the equipment, he's the only person doing all the work, shooting, editing, lighting, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Then that is the one singular piece of work that will not be compromise artistically, right? But that's not the way it works. It's you have to hire people, camera people, you have to hire all this stuff. So now it's because it's a business, movies are a compromised art form. So it's kind of hard to criticize them because they're compromised, right? I still do, and I still try, and it makes me cry and it hurts my penis.
Let me see a doctor.
There's no help for me. Anyone that knows me, there's no hope for me. But the cool thing about Bill Watterson is that he did it.
Mm-hmm.
He is the one man show, and his work is not compromised in the least artistically. So it's like, even comic strips, by their nature, are a compromised medium in the sense that, look, you can be a freaking Michelangelo all you want, but at the end of the day, these things are here to sell papers.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked within that world and fought and wrangled and you know, every day he took sabbaticals. It was just like, I need breaks, you know. And
I got to like even hand it to the syndicate. I mean, in that beginning where he had no clout, they could have made dolls. You know, they technically own the rights to it. So, and I don't know if that's part because of the book sales we're doing. So I don't know all the behind the scenes, but the fact that they could have pushed that, you know, they could have said, sorry, bro, I'm going to get someone else to draw this now, you know, hit the bricks, Junior. So they withheld, they kept up their end of the bargain, which is rare as well.
Surprising as hell, right?
Yeah.
I think Bill Watterson has left it in the hands of fans like us to pass it along to the next generation. I think if you're considering how, you know, this current generation consumes media and the need for, you know, being on digital, you know, merchandising, you know, for awareness, things like that. I think when you think about it from that perspective, it you know, it leaves much to be desired. But then you've got like folks like us that are keeping his name alive, you know, like, see, I can imagine, you know, when Sammy comes of age, you'll probably be reading Calvin and Hobbes to her, right? Like, we are the generation.
I'm getting her a stuffed tiger.
And painting it yourself. Yeah, like, we are the generation, I think, that will keep Calvin and Hobbes alive. And in regards to the comic industry, Bill Watterson was actually just recently inducted into the Will Eisner Award Hall of Fame. I think he was inducted in 2020. So in regards to, like, the comic industry, they're still, you know, he's still making news. They're still, you know, showing their appreciation. But I would like to think, much like reading Calvin and Hobbes, the actual strips, it's not always, I don't think it's always going to come easy, right? Like, Watterson never spoon fed, you know, you the jokes or the meanings and things like that. I don't think he's worried if a new generation finds it or gets it. I think, you know, it's a chapter of his life that is now closed that he put his all into and he enjoyed. And I would imagine that for him, it's like, well, if you find it and you love it, great. If you don't, that's on you.
Yeah, I don't think he's that concerned with legacy.
I'll tell a story that is to your point. When he was in Ohio, he would very sneakily go into a bookstore and autograph his books and then put them back in there for people to buy and not tell anybody. You know,
you think he ever got caught? Like, hey, this asshole's writing in the books. Get him.
He stopped doing it because people were selling them online.
Yeah.
And when he found out, he was like, okay, Jesus, I can't even
have
do
nice
this.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn. I've never met someone so allergic to capitalism than Bill Watterson. Like, I love it.
It's like, I tried to do, fuck you guys. You'll never see me again. Ninja vanish.
All right. With that said, the chances of Bill ever hearing this episode are definitely slim to none. He doesn't have a Twitter. I don't even think he's probably got a phone.
No, Mr.
Watterson, I'm so sorry if we've offended you.
He's in the woods painting. He's painting a lake somewhere.
Exactly.
I can't live my life knowing if I've made him mad or if he doesn't like me. I don't want to know.
Nah, he's on that Bob Ross tip. He's like, it's all right, brother. You guys suck, and that's okay. Embrace it. I probably got to see you to laugh.
I got my cabin made out of gold. I got my 2,500 acres in Ohio.
And not only that, but he doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that would indulge himself in praise. Anyways, but regardless, I think we did him and Calvin and Hobbes proud with this episode. I think we covered as much as we could for today's intent and purposes. So I'll address the listeners, all right? If you enjoyed this deep dive and this style of conversation, check out other artist spotlights that we've done, like the one we did about Rick Remender, one of the hardest working names in comics, back in episode 369. And if you're a fan of Calvin and Hobbes, if you know something about Bill Watterson that we don't know, that you'd like to share with us, man, chime into the conversation. Shoot us an email, hit us up on Twitter or Instagram. Let me know if you want me to share it on the episode. We'd love to hear from fellow Calvin and Hobbes fanatics. Let's get to our next topic for today, all right? And that's looking at the future of comics and the titles worth picking up next month. Let's go ahead and grab a fistful of comics.
You can either have a mouthful of teeth or a fistful of comics.
Fistful of Comics is a segment dedicated to helping all you comic curious newbies and regular Wednesday warriors find the best new titles worthy of your time and attention.
Of course, we are lucky enough to be joined by Ben Kingsbury for this part of the show. He's the owner of Gotham City Limit, Jacksonville's premier comic shop, and nothing makes this man happier than helping people take their comic shopping experience to the limit. He has provided me with a list.
Oh, you haven't heard
anyone?
This.
Scarface anyone?
I love it that you're like, and it's like, look, only 2 seconds, only two mm-hmm. seconds. So we won't be busted for copyright infringement.
That's funny. All right. Ben has provided me, first of all, before I get into that, Ben was really excited to hear that we were doing a Calvin and Hobbes episode today. Ben's already at a 10, right, as far as energy goes. When he heard we were doing a Calvin and Hobbes episode, his energy's now like at a 15. So we did something really special with this week's list and recommendations. Like he always does, he provided me with a list of three new comics that he thinks are worthy of the short box stamp of approval. I'm going to get the music going, and we're going to see what's on the agenda today. All right, first up. So like I said, he was super excited about the Calvin and Hobbes. He's got a whole theme for these recommendations, and an interesting one at that. So I'm going to let him tell you what his first pick is.
Good morning, good afternoon, and or good evening, Short Box listeners. I'm Ben Kay, representing Gotham City Limit, Jacksonville, Florida. And these are my three final order cutoffs you should add to your pull list immediately. You know what's weird? Day by day, nothing seems to change. But pretty soon, everything is different. That's probably one of my favorite Bill Watterson quotes. I'm a huge Calvin and Hobbes fan. Still own all my original Calvin and Hobbes books from when I was a young man. My best friend, Pacer the Amazing Shop Dog, and I live our lives like we imagined Calvin and Hobbes would. So in honor of Calvin and Hobbes, here's my FOC picks with a little dynamic duo twist. First up, Marvel Comics Rogue and Gambit number one. Destiny strikes for your favorite X-Men duo. With Destiny kidnapping Rogue, it's time to hop on for a thrill ride with Rogue and Gambit that will lay bare some of Krakoa's biggest secrets. Calvin and Hobbes, Rogue and Gambit, peanut butter and jelly. Add this to your pull list now.
That's funny.
I would have never thought to imagine to put Rogue and Gambit in the same conversation as peanut butter and jelly and Calvin and Hobbes. All right, Rogue and Gambit number one comes out March 1st. That's the first pick on Ben's list. This next one continues this theme of dynamic duos, but Ben's taking us to outer space to highlight a iconic dynamic duo in comic books. Here's Ben for you.
Next up on the list, another dynamic duo, Han Solo and Chewbacca, issue number 10. Why issue number 10? Because this is the first issue of a major new event coming to the Star Wars universe. We all know the hardest part of going to a comic book shop is figuring out where to start. Well, if you love anything to do with Star Wars and or Han Solo Chewbacca, make sure you add this one to your pull list. Han Solo and Chewbacca, Calvin and Hobbes, peanut butter and jelly. Get this one added.
I'm going to tell you right now, I'm getting hungry. He needs to stop. I'm getting real hungry right now.
Han Solo and Chewbacca also hit shops March 1st. Get that on your pull if that piques your interest. And last but not least on this list, Ben is wrapping up strong. He's bringing us back Earthside for a husband and wife combo that we all know and love.
And finally, DC Comics presents Superman number one. What's this dynamic duo? Well, Superman and Clark Kent, of course. All right, well, that's a stretch. However, I needed to fit this one in. Joshua Williamson, who is absolutely crushing all of DC's new comics, including the Lazarus Planet series ongoing right now, is back to bring in the dawn of the new DC, Superman number one. Jamal Campbell doing the artwork. That's a dynamic duo in and of itself. So that's it. Those are my FOC's picks of the week. Thanks for being here. Remember, with great power comes great responsibility, and always take it to the limit.
There we go. That was Ben Kingsbury, ladies and gents. And you've just been taken to the limit.
All right. Our lawyers are they're backing down. They're backing down.
Our lawyers got
the stopwatches.
Right. That is fair use right there.
ladies and gentlemen, how many of your local comic book shop owners have the personality and the sheer chutzpah to go on this podcast and basically say, hey, look, guys, I'm going to be on here talking about peanut butter and jelly. just so you'll come into the store and have an experience. All right. Ben is willing to go out of his way to go crazy and be silly for the sake of you, the listener, to come out to Gotham City Limit and have an awesome experience at his store. Come on. You can't say no to this man. You guys got to go there. Get your butts over there, for God's sake. For Ben's sake.
I feel like if you buy any of these titles, Rogue and Gambit number one, Han Solo, Chewbacca, or Superman number one, Ben should give you a free peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
A free peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
I think that'd be a
great crustable. A crustable, at least.
A crustable. That's a little safer.
Easier to store.
Yeah. All right, gents, of the three options that Ben has given us, which one is worthy of making it on your pull list? Which one gets your stamp of approval? Go ahead, C.
Man, I have been in a real Superman kick recently. Oh. So I'm going to hit Superman for sure.
All right, cool. What about you, Ed?
I think as much as she is way too good for this douchebag, I'm going to do Rogue and Gambit.
Rogue murdered someone. What are you talking about? She's perfect for Gambit.
Still too good.
They're both like the trashiest people on the X-Men.
I'll take my trash Southern. Thank you. Well, they're both Southern. I'll non-Creole.
I think I'm going to echo C on this one. I'm going to go Superman number one because there's a shit ton of covers, alternate covers for that issue. And I'm here for it, man. DC has gotten my attention for a good bit now.
First non-Batman title in 6 months.
Right?
Shit.
Right? Yeah. So I'll probably check out Superman number one. And all that, it comes out sooner than the rest. And you guys know I'm impatient as hell. So I'm going to check that out. Well, listeners, that is the list for today. If any of those grab your attention, heed Ben's words, all right? Go to your local comic shops, get your pre-orders in, and a big shout out to Ben.
Get your sandwich.
Yeah, and get your that's the thing, see? If they're going to another comic shop, I mean, more power to them, but they ain't getting the
No. I didn't say go to another comic shop. I said go take it to the limit and get your sandwich.
There we go. Big shout out to Ben for the help this week, and remember, even if you're unfortunate to not live in Jacksonville, you bums, you can still take it to the limit by shopping at GothamCityLimit.com for comics and exclusive variants you won't find anywhere else.
Oh, wait. They can do it online?
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. They got no excuse. None.
All right. Next up, we'll talk about how we've been spending the non-comic reading parts of our free time. But we're going to go stretch our legs for a little bit and go on a quick music break. I've been, I'm still finding new stuff in this music folder that DJ Crumbs gave me a few years ago. And it always feels like I'm coming across a new song I like. And this is one of them. So enjoy the music and we'll be right back. The music you just heard was by our good friend DJ Crumbs. Do me a favor, if you're on Instagram, give him a follow, all right? We got a link to his profile in the show notes. That's the least you could do. He's always giving us great music. Big shout out to DJ Crumbs. Now, we've got no emails to read today, but if you feel like we missed anything too glaring during our Calvin and Hobbes segment, maybe you know something that we don't know, or maybe you have a favorite memory of reading Calvin and Hobbes that you want to share with us, I invite you to reach out to us on Instagram, Twitter, or email. And you may have noticed that Cesar hasn't interrupted me yet, and that's because he had to drop off, or he had to go. Daddy duty was calling, so he had to drop off a little early. But we are fortunate enough that we got him for at least an hour in that last segment. So it'll just be me and Ed doing the rest of this show, but we're getting close to the finish line, anyways. It is now a perfect time to tell you about the best entertainment options worthy of your time, personally backed by us. It's time for Champion Season.
It's time for Champion Season.
Champion Season is a part of the show where we highlight the movies, TV series, books, video games, and other entertainment options that we've been spending our free time on. Ed, it's just you and me, so if you don't mind taking it first, I'll close it up.
Yeah, I want to just kind of go with the theme of Calvin and Hobbes. There's another comic strip that I really like called The Far Side by Gary Larson.
Oh, classic.
There is a big book called, if you like to get the artist's annotation, and just to see how funny Gary Larson is, it's a book came out a while ago. It's called The Prehistory of the Far Side. There's a giant dinosaur skeleton with one of his weird little ugly people he drew. But that has a lot of like talking about complaints he's gotten and just struggles dealing with the syndication and just coming up with ideas and how he came up with ideas and his, cause he has a very odd sense of humor. But I've always enjoyed his work. So that's one to check out. Another one is I'm going to champion a 90s book called Body Bags by Jason Pearson. Jason Pearson he passed away last month, but they just recently announced it this week. And he was part of a studio Gaijin in Atlanta with like guys like, you know, Brian Stelfreeze was another big guy, another, I think, super underrated artist. 12 Gauge Studios, I believe, but he did a lot of work for Marvel and DC. He had a run on Deadpool. I remember meeting him 2010 at a Heroes Con. I saw that he was going to be there, and this was probably maybe 10 plus years. And I brought my Body Bags issues with me because it's like, oh man, I like this guy. I had no idea what he looked like. No idea. So I was just going in there blind. It's like, oh, cool. He's here. He was like the main guy I wanted to see, surprisingly. I went up to him. He's a really cool guy. He was like dressed in a suit, looked like a million bucks. He was so cool. And I showed him the body bags, and it was like he saw like a relic. Like, oh man.
People body read bags. This shit?
Yeah, he was looking at it. He's like, man, I haven't seen this, and no one's brought me this in forever, you know? Because yeah. He's been working at that time, he was, you know, doing Deadpool run. So he was in the, I guess, major leagues, if you want to use that terminology. It's like, man, this is cool, man. I really appreciate you bringing this to me. So I bought a couple prints. He signed. He was just really cool guy. Like I said, he definitely stood out because he wasn't, you know, he was dressed up. He represented himself really well. And I was talking to him and I was like, man, I'd love for you to go back and do more, you know, body bag stuff. And he's like, man, I love to, but man, Deadpool pays the bills, man. You know, I got to do this. And that's kind of where I put it. It's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Kind of understanding kind of more of the business side of things. But I followed him on Facebook and Instagram. He's had some issues over the years. They're not, you know, nothing secret. If you followed him on Facebook, he said some pretty crazy stuff, but I know he was getting his demons in order. Unfortunately, he was working on a new body bags that he had kickstarted a few years ago. So he was wrapping that up. Hopefully we'll see something from that. I'm not 100% sure what the progress was, but like I said, he's one of those guys that I think should have been bigger than he was, you know, selfishly. It's like, this guy should have been in that top tier of 90s guys. His stuff was so cool. I think body bags now would be a little problematic. I think you'd have to tweak some things. But I still love that world. I love the characters. He draws action really well.
Dude, this looks, I'm just looking it up on Google right now. These covers are awesome. I've never seen this.
Yeah, he's, like I said, he's done work for everybody, but I think probably one of his biggest runs was his Deadpool run. He might have gotten a year on that, but he had a lot of personal issues and things, but he was still working. He was still cranking work out. And like I said, he was working on a new body bags story, but stuff was so animated. Yeah. So it's like, it was just so cool. So stylized, so cool. Like I said, he should have been one of the,
I believe the best.
For sure. Like I said, the way he put pages together. And you know, like I said, he was just a cool dude overall. And it sucks that he passed away. But he did a short run, I think he did a short 4-issue mini Savage Dragon spinoff series. So he's one of the few guys that drew Savage Dragon besides Eric Larson. So like I think it's Baptism of Fire. I'm not sure. It's kind of its own standalone thing. Really cool stuff. If you haven't heard of him, check out his work. Like I said, revisit some of his stuff, but I'm going to champion him because like I said, he was only 52. I believe he had a heart attack or a stroke. I'm not sure. I got some conflicting articles saying some different things, but you know, I've been following him for a while and I know he was kind of, you know, turning things around and looked like he was kind of getting back into it. And then unfortunately it's just one of those stories that like not everything works out like you think it should, but he was one of those guys that had unlimited potential. He should have been, like I said, he should have been one of the top guys coming into current times. Cause like I said, he has 1000% had the skill and the style for it.
Thank you for sharing that, Ed. You're always putting me on to some stuff, man. And this looks like something I should have been on. So thank
you. Yeah, it was originally a Dark Horse book, but Image did a kind of collected it and did kind of like a recolored collection of it. So it should be out there. It's easy to find. I actually just picked up a copy. So
cool.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Ed. Mm-hmm. I've got two champions today. One is a manga. It is called Adam the Beginning. It is by Osamu Tezuka gets credit on this because it's Astro Boy based. But the other two authors on this is Tetsuro Kasahara and Masami Yuki, I believe is how you say it. So it serves as a prequel to Astro Boy by following the lives of the two main scientists from that series, Umataro Tenma and Hiroshi Ochano Mizu, I think is how you say it. So it follows like them in college, like studying robotics, building their first AI and, you know, having to do like, you know, robot wrestling and fighting rings to like make money because they're part of like a really kind of low tier school. So they have to do whatever they can to make money.
And Robot Wars. Genius.
Yeah, exactly. I would describe it as, and I know that Marvel's done a series like this. I just don't know the specific name, but I would describe it as a series. If they made a series about like Professor X and Magneto's younger years, like, you know how you have like those two conflicting and sometimes overlapping mythologies,
like
and
Reed Richards, Victor Von Doom.
Exactly. Yeah. Like two like genius scientists with like conflicting personalities, but they still get along because they respect each other's work. And it's like just telling this story of their origin and, you know, kind of split early on. There's a lot of action in this manga series. The style is artistically fresh. The storytelling is really interesting with it being a prequel and, you know, adding something new to, you know, something that is iconic, right? Like Astro Boy, the god of manga, Osamu Tezuka's work. You know, it's definitely a big, I think it's a ballsy task to want to tell the prequel story to something like Astro Boy. But they managed to pay like proper homage to the source material.
Show you how it should have been done, old man. This is all right, I guess. But let me, this is what you should have done. No, it is like a big shadow.
It is.
Sure.
So far, it's been really fun. Do you remember Metabots? Remember that cartoon show, Metabots? We loved it
cool.
as a kid. So it's like, if you enjoyed Metabots and you love stories about the morality of artificial intelligence or like Blade Runner and stuff like that, then Adam the Beginning is worthy of picking that up. It's only two volumes of the manga have been translated to English. There's a third one coming out in February. But I've consumed both of the first two volumes. I love it. I highly recommend it if you're looking for something manga to read. And my second champion is the Invincible Season 2 trailer that we got this week. Ed, you had posted it on our Instagram, and I ended up watching it again for like the second or third time this morning before we recorded. And for those of you that might be scratching your head, maybe you missed it. It's really just a short vignette that really was kind of like a meta commentary of Invincible and Alan the Alien sharing Alan Alien is eating a hamburger and Invincible is really just kind of like watching him. But they kind of just have a conversation. It's a meta commentary addressing like the release date, you know, providing an update why it's taken so
long. Late 2023.
Yeah, right. super, super meta, but it's a funny interaction between Mark and Alan, and Seth Rogen, you know, is in prime form. And what I got out of it was, look, motherfuckers, it takes a lot to make an animated series. And Ed, I don't
like
know.
Character design, that, it's like half layout. Of that sounds made up.
Yeah. And Ed, do you agree? Maybe my eyes were playing tricks on me, but I feel like the animation looks better.
It looks pretty sharp.
Yeah, it looks like really good. So if they needed all this time to get the animation looking right and whatnot, I'm here for it. It sounds like it'll come out this year.
Got that Bezos bucks going.
Right? Hopefully this is better than that Lord of the Rings series. But I am excited for Invincible. I'm glad that we at least got a trailer to hold us off. And that's what I'm a champion. So I've got the manga, Adam the Beginning, and Invincible Season 2
trailer. I know about that manga. It looks cool. I like the redesigns.
I'm telling you, it is rad, man. Like, you could tell they spent the way they draw the different robots, and they're all, like, you know, based on, like, the classic robots from the main Astro Boy series. There's another series called Pluto. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. I forget the name of the, I'll try to look it up. But there's a manga series called Pluto that also kind of served as a, a kind of a weird tie-in slash a retelling of Astro Boy. Oh, here it is. It was written and illustrated by Neko Urasawa. And it was a murder mystery. It revolved around, like, this detective, just like this android that was a detective. And there was a murder mystery going around. Someone was killing all of the original robots, and all the original robots were like Astro Boy characters. That manga, Pluto, it's long as hell. There's 8 volumes of it in total, but it is so good. So that was another series where the writer was like, I love Astro Boy. I want to do the story that ties into it. That's more of an homage. Yeah, I know it's cool. Sacrilege to even think I could, you know, add to the lore that that Osama has done, but please. And, you know, both of these have gotten the blessings from the family.
That's cool.
So that's a bonus one. Shortbox Nation, that's the end of this segment. It's your turn to chime in, all right? This is your homework, right? Tell us if you got a killer champion that we should check out, or if you try out any of the recommendations that we shared today. We'd love to get some feedback. Hit us up on Instagram, Twitter, or email, all right? Ed, since it's just me and you, man, this will be an easy one because I could just look at you and ask, do you got any parting words, any lessons learned or words of wisdom that we should share with the listeners before we sign off?
Don't sell out.
Not even for a fucking dollar, right? I don't care if it's one stuffed animal. God damn it. You are not merchandising. I like this quote that Bill Watterson says, and I think it's kind of encapsulates, you know, his whole leaving Calvin and Hobbes and maybe his ethos. But it's, quote, it's always better to leave the party early. I like that he was conscious enough to see that, like, he had hit, like, the pinnacle in this high, and there was probably really, I'm sure that he probably could have had another solid run and years of acclaim and fame, but I like that he made the hard decision of, I'm gonna leave early. It's the opposite of what Kanye West tells you to do, which is don't leave while you're hot. That's how Mace screwed up.
It's like, we can't miss you if you don't go away.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, there you have it, Shortbox Nation. Thank you for hanging out with us this week. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and help spread the word to a friend or someone you know that loves comics as much as we do. Next week, we are taking a break, right? Well, we're going to drop something on our Patreon to hold over our number one fans. But as far as regular weekly episodes, we're going to take a break next week. We'll come back the following with something for you. So this is why I encourage you, if you just can't wait, if you love having Shortbox content every week to hold you over, become a member of our Patreon community, all right? You'll get access to bonus episodes and videos, and we got an episode voting poll going up by the time this episode drops to help us pick the topic for a future episode. So if you want to take part in that and enjoy all those extra rewards and perks, click the link in the show notes or go to patreon.com/theshortbox to check out what's waiting for you there. Until we meet again, Shortbox Nation, take care of yourselves. Have a great day. And please continue to make mine and yours Shortbox. We'll talk to you soon. Peace.